Good morning, Council. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, October 19th, 2022. We have six cases on our calendar today. Five are set for oral argument, four of which are in person. This is the third of the fourth case for in-person oral argument. This is A22-0467, Husky Construction Incorporated versus Justin G. Thibault. Is that, Thibault. Feel free to correct me after. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial argument. Please feel free to be seated. You'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record, the party you're representing, and any preferred ways that you'd like us to refer to either you or to your clients. And you'll have questions throughout, either from myself or Judge Randy Slater or Judge Jennifer Frisch. And with that, counsel, for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Rich Fobel from the Fellhaber Law Firm on behalf of the appellant E2HS. And Your Honors, we're here today on an appeal of the district court's denial of appellant's motion to dismiss based on a lack of personal jurisdiction. I'd like to start by highlighting a few facts that I think are really important to help put this dispute in context. So just briefly, Your Honors, appellant is a Canadian distributor of hydroseeder and erosion control products. What they do is they advertise their products in a magazine called Market Book Canada. As the name suggests, the advertisement is geared toward people in Canada, and specifically Eastern Canada. But what happens by virtue of placing an advertisement in this print magazine is it automatically gets placed on a website called machinerytrader.com. There's no choice. As part of advertising in the print, it automatically gets placed on the internet.
Well, when you say there's no choice, I mean your client's aware that when it places an ad in Market Book Canada that the ad is going to necessarily be placed by as part of that purchase of the ad space in the magazine, that it's going to go on the internet as well.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you're right. I think maybe it's more accurate to say there was no choice to opt out of an internet posting.
Can I ask a question about the toll-free number?
Yeah.
Is that number directed to your client, or is that a number that, it's just not clear from the record if that number was part of something that was provided by Machinery Trader or Market Book Canada?
Sure. And the way I understand it is that number is provided by Machinery Trader. It goes to their call center, if you will, and then it's routed to my client.
And your client, when it was when the phone call from Husky was routed to your client answered the telephone in French, is that correct?
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
And your client has never done business in Minnesota before or since, is that right?
That is correct. Outside of this transaction, zero contacts with Minnesota.
All right.
And so again, just to, I guess, put this dispute in perspective, on April 29th, respondent saw the ad, called my client to ask about the hydroseeder unit. My client could not speak at that time, said, I'll call you back, grabbed the information about the hydroseeder unit, called him back the same day, and they had a discussion about it. During that discussion, respondent asked to see some pictures of the unit. So my client obliged, sent him an email with some pictures. The pictures showed that the unit was attached to a truck, a GMC truck, which is necessary in order to operate the unit in the fields. Respondent then asked my client, said, is this truck available? Would you sell that to me? Said, yes, I'll sell it to you. They worked it into the transaction, and the deal was done that day.
When you say the deal was done, you're talking about one single transaction that consisted of both the hydroseeder and the truck, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yep.
One purchase price.
Yes, there was one price for both units.
And, counsel, you would agree that even one incident can meet the standard, correct?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, yes.
So let me just to piggyback on Judge Reyes's question, I mean, I've read all the cases that you cited in your brief. I've read all the cases that Husky cited in its brief as well. One of the challenges that we have in a specific personal jurisdiction space is that for every case where there's one transaction that does not substantiate a finding of specific personal jurisdiction. There's another case consisting of one business transaction that does substantiate a finding of specific personal jurisdiction. And I realize that when we're dealing with contractual disputes like this one, that we look at the totality of circumstances, the negotiations, the terms of the types of contacts that occurred, and the circumstances surrounding the business transaction. I'm just wondering if there's some clarity that we can offer in this space so we don't end up reverting to, well, I've got five cases that say no jurisdiction, and I've got five cases that say there is jurisdiction. Is there something specific that we can contribute in this in that regard?
Yes, very good question. You know, I think from the cases, my read of them is that although there are cases that fall both ways, it seems to me that the default is that personal jurisdiction does not exist in single transaction cases. I know there are cases that go the other way, but I think they're factually distinctive. In the KSTP versus Specialized case, it was a 1999 Court of Appeals case. Court said personal jurisdiction does not generally exist when a non-resident defendant makes a single isolated sale of its goods in the forum state. An isolated sale is especially unlikely to create personal jurisdiction if the non-resident has not targeted the forum state in a marketing campaign. So I think in cases where they do find a personal jurisdiction based on a single transaction, it's much more complex. There's way more stuff going on, active solicitation. It's not just picking up a phone call and making a sale.
I mean, this isn't a money mutual case. This is not really.
Right.
I mean, there's not like targeted advertising, but there are other cases where a singular business transaction can result, even when there's not targeted marketing, in a finding of specific personal jurisdiction.
And I'm not doubting that, Your Honor. I don't believe respondent has cited to any of those cases in the briefs, and I'd be happy to distinguish them if they did. But the Money Mutual and the Marquette case, those are definitely different animals.
Mr. Vogel, can I ask to follow up on that? Because I looked at the cases too, and I can't recall seeing this, and perhaps counsel for respondent will point it out if I missed it. Is there any case with a single contact transaction that was initiated by the plaintiff / as in here buyer?
Initiated by the buyer.
Right. The point you've highlighted, of course, factually we know that this entire transaction commenced with the plaintiff buyer initiating the contact. It's a single transaction, and I couldn't find a case similar to that where the very first contact was initiated by the plaintiff. Now, I may have missed it, and
I don't think there is either. I don't think that was in the briefs either.
My question is, and it seemed to be a point in the Marquette case that even there it was involving those stock, as I recall, was commenced and somewhat aggressively so, apparently, by the out-of-state party. And so is that an important distinction in trying to delineate between these single transactions? Because I know it's the same thing, too, for everyone. I mean, that's why you got the cases, of course, that you both cited.
Right. No, I think that is a distinction. I think the more complex of the transaction there is and the more active solicitation, like the Marquette case or the Money Mutual case, I think those are different. I think those could be single transaction where personal jurisdiction exists. But I didn't see a case in the briefs, and I'm not saying it's not out there, but where a single transaction rendered personal jurisdiction based on picking up a phone call and when there's no targeted activities toward Minnesota. That answers your question.
Yes, thank you.
one of the other themes that I see in this space is the emphasis on the connection between the non-resident defendant and the forum jurisdiction, not the plaintiff, as distinct from the plaintiff. Can you talk about just talk about that concept in terms of the factual underpinnings of this case?
Yes, I can. And I think the contacts here, when you look at it in that light, it's not towards Minnesota. It's a fortuitous contact that respondent happened to be in Minnesota. Respondent could have been in Iowa, Wisconsin, and just happened to be in Minnesota and made that phone call. There was no direct action where My client was advertising to Minnesota or sought to do business with Minnesota residents. It just happened to be a Minnesota resident.
And that may be true with respect to the first contact, but once your client starts engaging with Husky on an active, consistent basis, does that convert those contacts into contacts with the forum jurisdiction?
And I would argue it doesn't. And I think that's why it's really important to kind of get in the weeds on the facts of this case, because the whole transaction transpired in 7 days. And I know respondent likes to kind of group them all together and saying the emails and the phone calls, but we're talking about maybe two phone calls, maybe three emails. And the emails and phone calls really just support what was in the initial advertisement, that this was a refurbished hydro-seeder unit. I don't think that the fact that they made these phone calls and these emails and they knew respondent was in Minnesota changes that analysis. I don't think it then becomes, oh, you're targeting Minnesota purposefully, in my opinion.
And is the relevant inquiry when we're talking about targeting Minnesota the inquiry about whether your client is purposefully availing itself of the laws and protections of the forum state?
That's right.
And what would be the purpose, and I'm going to ask this question of Husky as well, but what would be the purpose of availing yourself or of the company availing itself of the laws and protections of Minnesota through this business transaction? Or is there one?
Well, I don't think in this scenario there is one. I think if you were to ask how that would come about, I think if my client targeted Minnesota and did an advertisement specifically to farmers of Minnesota, sent emails to known farmers of Minnesota looking for that business, to me, those activities are targeting Minnesota. You're looking for the protection of Minnesota law. You want to do business in Minnesota, and that would fall under that category. That's not what we have here today.
And from the perspective of your client, the transaction was complete upon the shipment of the equipment, correct? There's no tail here.
There's no tail, and I would even argue that the transaction was complete within those 7 days after respondent wired the money to Husky. It is true that I think there was about 20 days after the money was wired that my client did some additional maintenance before it was shipped, but the deal was done in the first 7 days. That was just merely finishing off some maintenance and sending it. It wasn't a basis of the bargain, I guess, if you will. And there's definitely no tail in this case.
Can I follow up on that, counsel, just to clarify, because it wasn't quite clear to me that the first day, the only day of the telephone conversation that essentially reached the price for the two items, was there a purchase agreement sent and signed that very day?
I believe it was sent with the, on May 1st, there was an email confirmation saying thank you for your order, and then on May 4th the invoice was sent with the wiring instructions, as I believe how
I see. Yep. And so there was no changes of any kind?
Correct.
So essentially that April 29 day that was the deal. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like Your Honors definitely have picked up on the issues here. I think it goes without saying that second factor is kind of the dispositive factor in this case, because it's a single sales transaction. And I'd argue that the nature and quality of the contacts here do not rise to the level to confer jurisdiction. The four cases we cite are on point. The RH case in particular by Judge Doty, it was the same website involved almost to a T, except for in that case, the seller was much more aggressive and called the Minnesota buyer, I think, 20 times over a month to get him to purchase the unit. Eventually did. Court said, even in totality, that's not enough to make or to confer personal jurisdiction.
But the RH case, that's a federal district court case.
It is, Your Honor, yes. Okay. See, my time is almost up. Unless the court has any questions or wants me to address a different portion of the argument, I'll turn it over to respondent.
I don't think so. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 15 minutes. And I forgot to mention that we do have a podium in the middle if you want to use that one. And that one you can lower and raise it. There's a button underneath to do that. And you can see the timer a little bit easier as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was actually going to ask that question, so I appreciate you bringing that up. I like having the time there.
Yeah. My apologies, counsel for appellant.
No problem.
May it please the court, my name is Courtney Ernston and I represent the respondent Husky Construction, Inc. in this matter. The question presented today before the court is whether the appellant participated in sufficient contacts with Minnesota as to anticipate being brought into Minnesota courts. The answer to this question is yes. Judge Frisch, I'd like to address your question, which was, how do we get out of this situation where we have all of these cases, and like you said, we get seemingly different results from largely very similar similar facts. And Judge Reyes, as you pointed out, the RH case is a federal case. And the trend that I noticed was that the federal cases seem to weigh in favor of not extending jurisdiction, whereas the Minnesota case law that we have that's been presented in the respondent's brief is usually in favor of retaining jurisdiction.
But counsel, we do have a lot of Minnesota Supreme Court cases, including our most recent pronouncement on specific personal jurisdiction in Bandemir, where I think the quote is, we simply look to the federal law in Minnesota to determine the exercise of jurisdiction. And so I'm not persuaded that we're in a position where we should be distinguishing federal cases when our Supreme Court is telling us to look to them.
And I understand that, Your Honor. However, I would say that because we have a bevy of case law that states that, again, kind of bringing this back to your original question, which is how do we avoid this? Unfortunately, I think the answer is the reason we have a totality test is exactly because of situations like this. Because it's not just these piecemeal individual component parts of the transaction, as the appellant likes to portray this. It is a totality test. So, for example, when we look at the Sonneborg case, which is, in my opinion, the only case that has been the Court of Appeals case that has very, very, very similar fact pattern in terms of it was a piece of equipment. But the Sonneborg case has very, very different facts that differentiate it from the present case. So in the Sonneborg facts, the contract was done via facsimile as opposed to email. The purchaser of the equipment went to Georgia and picked up the equipment, whereas in this case, the appellant not only shipped it, but the appellant was responsible for obtaining all of the customs information on behalf of sending this equipment, filled out the customs paperwork, filled out all the shipping, organized the shipping, and had it shipped to Minnesota. In the Sonneborg case, the number was a local Georgia number, not a toll-free number, as Your Honor pointed out earlier. And regardless of whether that toll-free number was created by the website or it was created by the appellant, it was a toll-free number. And in that advertisement, the appellant could have simply said, we only do business in Eastern Canada, here's our number. But they didn't do that. And as Your Honor pointed out,
I'm trying to understand the distinction, the importance of any of those distinctions, looking at the case law, and especially since we have I believe it's the Riley decision that just simply says a website or a national one is really of no significance. Isn't that really what all these issues you're talking about? Isn't the importance of how this entire transaction commenced as opposed to how it finished after the agreement's reached?
Well, Your Honor, I think what it is it's a component part of the totality. So when we look at the totality here, we've got an advertisement that the appellant knows is being put out into the U.S. residents, even though it's stating that it only does things in Canada, but it doesn't make any sort of...
Where's that in the record? I don't see that in the record, that E2HS knew that its advertisement was being put into the United States or into Minnesota specifically.
Your Honor, I do not know the exact citation, but there was documents that were submitted in the original district court record that regards how the Market Book Canada, this is its residence, and then the Machinery Trader, it specifically states that it's a U.S. publication. And so I know that it is in the record as it relates to how the Machinery Trader is specifically a United States publication. And so if it goes on to Machinery Trader, that's a U.S. website.
We've kind of danced around RH seal coding a little bit. And I confess that I have studied this case quite extensively, and I am struggling to find a factual distinction in your favor, counsel. I mean, I do think that in that case, the non-resident defendant was even more of an aggressor than E2HS was in this particular case. And it does seem to me to square almost entirely on all fours. I want to give you an opportunity to convince me otherwise, because I'm not persuaded that simply because it's a district court opinion from Judge Doty that we should disregard it, given its factual similarity and the Supreme Court's pronouncement that we should be simply looking at federal law.
Yes, Your Honor. As it relates to RH seal coating, so I want to make sure that I absolutely understand what you're saying in terms of looking to district court. However, there are certain facts that are contained in Minnesota state case law that must be taken into account. And for
and I'm familiar with the Minnesota case law too. I just want to hear your view on RH seal coating.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so where I'm going with that is as it relates to the aggressor. So the Minnesota state courts have had a number of cases that regard the aggressor. And so the RH seal coating case found that they were not the aggressor. However, I think that we must look to the Minnesota case law that specifically talks about who is the aggressor and what constitutes being an aggressor, which we look to the KSTP specialized communications case that says actively engaging in negotiation on the sales term can make a party an aggressor.
Can make a party. That doesn't mean it makes the party an aggressor.
Of course, Your Honor. But in this case, we have somebody that's actively engaging in the negotiation of not only the initial piece of equipment that was posted on the website, but a subsequent piece of equipment.
But that truck isn't part of the dispute here.
Correct, Your Honor. However, again, when we're looking at the totality, we're talking about the nature and quantity and quality of these contacts.
And Husky asked about the truck.
Your Honor, I don't know that the record is clear as to who asked about the truck.
I thought it was clear that Husky asked about the truck in addition to the main piece of equipment.
And perhaps they did ask about the truck, Your Honor, but my point is that E2 chose to engage in active negotiations.
But your argument seems to be on the aggressor, and the record reflects that Husky was the person who initiated the contact. So I have to admit, I'm struggling too. I mean, I think that RH case is very much on point. And, you know, when we can't just ignore the federal case law. And in fact, we're directed to do that. And we've done that many, many times. I mean, Judge Frisch referenced the Bandemer case. I wrote that opinion. So I'm intimately familiar with this, probably more than I want it to be. I'm struggling to see how, because I thought actually the court found that RH was the aggressor, and yet still said that there was no personal jurisdiction.
Correct, Your Honor. And I would just say that in terms of the aggressor, what I would ask the court to do is to look at the Viking case, because the Viking case was a recent case that was decided that says that regardless of who the initial aggressor is, subsequent interstate communications by a non-resident seller, E2HS, demonstrating an eagerness to enter into a business transaction is the equivalent to acting as an aggressor. And so going back to the totality, we have the initial phone call which said, I will call you back. At that point, if the appellant knew that this individual was in the United States in Minnesota, he could have simply said, I'm sorry, we only do business in Eastern Canada. He didn't do that.
But I still have a hard time understanding that, because I assume when we're just talking about the due process and the long-arm statute, that doesn't mean businesses have to ignore doing business. The question is, do they avail themselves by doing business, correct, as a general proposition?
Correct, Your Honor. So not only do they have to avail themselves by doing business, but in this case, because the appellant knew that he was in, that Husky was in Minnesota, and we also have the subsequent case law that talks about that if you purposely avail yourself, if you make a misrepresentation, which becomes the subject of the lawsuit, which, going to the totality, is yet another factor as to why.
What was the misrepresentation that was made?
The misrepresentation is the basis of the lawsuit, Your Honor, which was that the hydroseeder was refurbished. And
wasn't that made clear up front that it was refurbished equipment?
Correct, but the...
Okay, so how is that a misrepresentation to say that if it was already stated up front that it was refurbished equipment, this wasn't brand new equipment?
Correct, Your Honor. The misrepresentation is that the appellant stated it was refurbished when in fact it was not. So we have the repairs that were done, which going to the fifth factor as to the convenience, all of the original parts of the hydro seeder that the repair company had to take out, they were not refurbished. They were original pieces. And so that's the misrepresentation, is that it was refurbished, and he stated that there were new parts, all this new stuff was done, and when in fact it was not.
Clarify, though, that doesn't go to what the party seemed to consider as the dispositive second factor, does it? That goes to perhaps the connection between cause of action or something. But would you agree that doesn't really answer the dispositive factor number two, quality and nature of contacts?
Correct, Your Honor. It goes to the third factor.
And can I ask you the question I asked counsel for appellant? Were you able to find a case or could point it out to me if I missed it, in a single transaction in which the plaintiff commenced the contacts, such as in this case, and yet there was sufficient contacts for jurisdiction purposes?
I believe that was the Viking case, Your Honor, but I don't know off the... I apologize, I don't have a very clear answer to that, but I believe that that was the Viking case.
And when it comes to aggressor, would you agree that's a fairly kind of a limited category of importance in a limited category of cases, I should say? In other words, where there's perhaps a lot of contact and it's a little bit unclear as between whether who started it and et cetera, then that, and only then does that become important to see, well, okay, among all these contacts between the two of them, who was the one really pushing? And then that helps to answer the question, as opposed to perhaps, and it might arise out of a single contact, more often I assume it's in multiple transactions. But is that a fair summary of that? So that it's in the minority of cases, in other words, where this issue of aggressor really is an important factor to consider?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would somewhat disagree with that. Given that, again, and I hate to be so repetitive, but we have to look, this court must look at the totality. And the aggressor is a part of the totality based on the case law, specifically the Viking and the KSTP case law, where we have who the aggressor. So we have subsequent conversations being negotiated over all of the negotiations that happened. I mean, the appellant portrays that this was a, you know, everything was done in a day or 7 days at most. How can the appellant state that without delivery of the equipment that this deal is done?
Go ahead.
Counsel, one of the struggles that I'm having with your position is that you're summarizing contacts with E2HS, but you're not telling us how the company is purposefully availing itself of the laws and protections of the state of Minnesota. I mean, from its perspective, it's conducted its business transaction, and when it gets payment from your company, its job is done after it ships the truck off. And so what protections of the state of Minnesota is it gaining by engaging in business in this business transaction?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that there are some of the cases that discuss how if you are engaging it, looking at the totality, if you're engaging in these contacts, if you're exchanging all of this information, if you're actively shipping something to a Minnesota resident, but I think I know where you're going, Your Honor, and my response to that would be, in this particular case, when we look at the Dent Air case, it's because Minnesota has an interest in providing a forum for residents who have been wronged.
But we're talking about the due process concerns for E2HS. You're talking about the due process concerns for your client. So how are we addressing the due process concern for E2HS in conjunction with its purposeful availment of the laws and protections of the state?
Your Honor, my response to that would be somewhat similar to what I just stated, but perhaps I'm not saying it in such a way to address what you're saying, because I understand what you're saying, and my response to that would be, in your scenario, E2HS is purposely availing itself for some sort of a benefit or some sort of a protection. And my response to that would be, the reason that Dent Air stated what it stated is because if a party is the aggressor, it does all of these things, it falls under all of these totality circumstances like we have here, it should not be allowed to say, oh, I don't have, you know, my due process needs aren't being met, and therefore I shouldn't be hailed into to Minnesota court, even though what I did is the reason that this lawsuit is here in the first place, because of their bad actions. And that's why, Your Honor, it's related. And I understand what you're saying. I see that my time is up. May I briefly conclude?
Yes, you may.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but my point is, in this case, this is not simply a, you know, some sort of a generic contract dispute. My client is alleging that there was fraud and misrepresentation, and so E2HS should not be allowed to hide behind the due process clause when, looking at the totality here, there are sufficient minimum contacts to exercise jurisdiction.
Judge Reyes, I have an additional question,
sure.
If I may.
Yes, you may.
Counsel, I'm just going to take you to one additional subject matter that I wanted to ask you about, and that is, in your brief, you indicate that some of the post-transaction contacts between your client and E2HS when Husky is complaining about the condition of the hydroseeder also lend itself to jurisdiction. Can you give me a principled reason why that is so? I mean, when I read the cases, it looks to me that we consider or we focus on the contacts between the non-resident defendant that give rise to the cause of action, but not the contacts that may occur after the cause of action has accrued. Do you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And simply what it was is again, it was my attempt and effort to say, look at all of these different things and following the case law, the totality. And because in when there is doubt, we must resolve in favor of jurisdiction. That was the point of that, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Again, Rich Fobel on behalf of appellant. I'd just like to answer a couple of questions that were posed to respondent. You asked about the record on who asked about the truck. In my client's declaration, it's clear that Husky was the one that asked about the truck. There was a question about, or a distinction made that because the advertisement was placed on the Machinery Trader website, it was a U.S. publication, and that has some sort of significance. I think, as the Money Mutual case said, purely national advertising campaign that does not target Minnesota specifically cannot support a finding of personal jurisdiction. I also want to touch on the totality. Respondent argues that you got to look at the totality. And while that's true, there really isn't a whole lot here. The totality is very limited. A couple phone calls, a couple emails. The advertisement had the information about being a refurbished unit right there. That's the crux of the dispute, whether it was refurbished or not. The totality of the circumstances are a phone call, agree on the price, emails about shipping information, and they send it. And then lastly, just to touch on Judge Frisch's comment about post-sale communications, you're exactly right that attempts to fix or settle disputes are not used to establish personal jurisdiction, and that's the KSTP case. Unless Your Honors have any other questions or any areas you want me to address, that's all I have.
Thank you.
Looks like no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. Both were very well done. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you.